This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. We have three interviews for you: local foods as a climate lifeboat, hot new science on coral's last stand, and a report from, yes, Portland still standing against the end of the world. Let's get talking. We have to be suspicious of our food these days. Who knows what's on it, you know, pesticides or whether it's genetically malformed or where it came from? Not to mention the insane carbon miles of flying fresh food halfway around the world to supermarket. That's no way to live. And there are food revolutionaries out there. Michael Brownlee has been in this good food fight for years. In 2011, I interviewed Michael about the transition movement. In 2016, we talked about his book, The Local Food Revolution: How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times. Now Michael's back and he's gone a step further. He's got a new book linked up with an online video and a training course coming. And the book is Reclaiming the Future: How to Lead the Local Food Revolution in Your Community. Michael Brownlee, a warm welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be with you again.
It's been a long struggle to keep local food growing. How's it going in Colorado?
Well, actually, it appears to be going well in Colorado with local food, but as we have learned over the years, we have actually not moved the needle very much. We're still at somewhere between 1 and 2% local food in this state. We're about, I think, number 32 on the locavore index of states in the country.
Right. Well, I know that Canadian cities are getting more local food. I see it, well, it's partly due to that book, 100 Mile Diet, by Elisa Smith and James McKinnon that came out a few years ago.
Sure.
And I head into restaurants, I see they've got local food on the menu and they market very clearly, but I guess most of their menu is from somewhere else. And we've got busy farmers markets. On the days when farmers markets are open, it looks about as busy as some supermarkets. So I see those as signs of progress, but like you say, long way to go.
Long way to go. And as a nation, the United States is, well, actually, if we look at the total food supply in this country, which is about a $5.3 trillion market, local food represents 0.3% of all of that. So what that means is that the rest of our food supply is industrial food, you know, and the problem is not just that, you know, it's better for us, better for our health, better for the environment of all that to be eating local food. The problem is that the industrial food system, which dominates our food supply almost entirely, is really the most destructive industry in the world, and it's the number one contributor to global warming. So we've been feeling the need to localize our food supply as much as possible over, you know, the last dozen years or so. But unfortunately, local food has become seen as primarily an optional lifestyle choice for the economically privileged. So local food has never been seen as something important, let alone urgent, for communities to take on as an overriding priority.
Right. If we go down to City Hall where we live and ask them, well, what are you doing about local food? They may have some inkling. They may have a small project, but that isn't what they spend most of their time talking about.
That's right. And, you know, part of the reason for this is that people have a poor understanding in general of the industrial food system and how destructive it is. And even more importantly, as we're learning now, almost no one realizes that the impact of global warming on the food supply will be tremendous in the next few decades. And the impact of all of that will be primarily on our industrial food system, on monocultured commodity crops, especially in the breadbasket regions of the world. So as we start to understand the new science that's becoming available to us around that, we start realizing, oh, we don't have any choice but to quickly localize our food supply in our communities on a regional basis to the greatest extent possible, because we're facing nothing less than a global food catastrophe that will reduce our food production capacity by in the neighborhood of half, 50%, by 2050. And that doesn't mean it's going to start in 2050. It's already started now. We're seeing the reduction of food production capacity because it turns out that warming, global warming, each degree Celsius of global warming that takes place, it cuts food production capacity, crop yields, in other words, by 10% per degree Celsius. So if you look at the numbers that some of your guests have been suggesting we might be facing, you know, anywhere from, 2 to 6 degrees Celsius over the next several decades, some of the more bold of them saying we could see 4 to 6 degrees even by 2050, we realize we're in serious trouble for our food system.
Yes, I see that all the time as a climate reporter, and I'm reminded, first off, of course, the California drought that just went by, and many, many acres of food that just had to be left out there. There was no water for them. But I'm thinking, too, of the 2010 extreme heat event that hit Russia, and their grain crops, and they're the breadbasket for a large part of Asia, were just burned out. They had to stop all grain exports, wheat exports, and that drove up wheat prices around the world. It was part of the reason, possibly, of the revolution in Egypt, where buying bread is about 50% of the budget of everybody that lives there. You know, it's just this chain reaction of things that can happen if you get extreme weather events. And scientists tell us quite plainly, you're going to get more and more extreme weather events. And along those lines, I noticed in your new book that you went to see the sequel, Al Gore's sequel of the climate movie?
Yes, An Inconvenient Truth, yeah.
Yeah, and you started thinking about what Al Gore did and how that could be applied to your local food leadership ideas. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, we were impressed by what Al Gore did. You know, back in, I guess it was 2006, when he released An Inconvenient Truth as a book and as a film, and his intention was to change the whole public conversation about climate change and global warming. And he'd been developing a very elaborate presentation for years. He tried to incorporate all the best and latest research that was available, but he realized that he was just one voice out there. So he decided, besides creating the documentary and the book of An Inconvenient Truth, that he would train a cadre of community activists who could take his message out to their communities and to policymakers all over the world, actually. And he's been very successful with this. So his new film, An Inconvenient Sequel, tells the story of how he's actually personally trained over, well, tens of thousands of people to go out throughout the world. And you know, whatever we might think about Al Gore today, I think the intention, the strategy actually was brilliant. So it inspired us to begin training a cadre of people to raise awareness about the necessity for localizing our food supply to the greatest extent possible as quickly as possible. So to do that, we did two things. One, we weren't quite ready to do a documentary film like Al Gore did, but we created a new book, Reclaiming the Future, How to Lead the Local Food Revolution in Your Community. And then we also created what we're calling the Local Food Academy, which is a three-month, very intensive training program for people who feel called to this work, who actually want to learn how they can radically accelerate and expand the local food movement in their communities. So we launched that in November, and we're getting ready to do the second version of that in March.
Now, is that a workshop where people go to Colorado to attend, or are you doing it online, or how does that work?
It's all online, with the exception of we're doing weekly sessions with people. There's a lot of online material that we offer them. And then at the end of the 3 months, we bring everybody together in Colorado for a three-day workshop. So we're planning four of those workshops a year. We're trying to build a community, a global community, actually, of food shed catalysts, if you will, people who are taking responsibility for leading this local food revolution in their communities. So it's a fairly radical approach, but it's a time-honored approach. You know, Richard Heinberg at Post Carbon Institute several years ago told us about the populist movement and the Farmers Alliance that grew up in the 1890s against corporate dominance of then both the Democratic and Republican parties. And so what the populist movement did was they trained a core of thousands of speakers to fan out across the country and to wake people up about that issue. They actually went out on horseback all over the country. Fortunately, we don't have to go out on horseback, but we can start right in our own communities and spread out from there.
But if we are going to other communities, horseback might be the way to go, a lot less carbon involved.
It's a little slow right now. And we need to move fairly quickly. We'll take advantage of, you know, automobile technologies and internet technologies and other communication technologies while they're available to us.
Okay, now, while they're available to us, and I think that this book assumes that we are on the verge of either an economic collapse or an ecological collapse or both, and I'm wondering, does this new local food movement depend on the collapse viewpoint, or can we find other reasons why we should be doing it and find enough drivers in those other reasons to make it happen? What do you think?
Well, there are lots and lots of good reasons for localizing our food supply, and we've been talking about them for years, but they haven't gotten a lot of traction. I know we thought that probably the one reason that would really take hold was for economic development and rebuilding local economies. But, you know, we experienced here in Colorado, and this is true in many other places, that economic development government leaders are just not interested in that, because so much of the current economy is based upon industrial food production for export. It's an export-oriented economy. So they have pretty much ignored the possibility of economic development benefits of local food. The health benefits are obvious to anyone who's looking at it, and many people are. Many people have changed their lives really significantly bringing local and organic food into their diets, and that's been a very promising development, but it's still such a tiny part of our total food intake that it's just not enough. But when it finally comes down to realizing that if we don't localize our food supply to a pretty significant degree, not too far down the road, we will be facing famine, and especially in our big cities, because they will just not have the capacity to feed themselves.
Tell us about Lynette Marie Hanthorn.
Yeah, Lynette Marie and I, she comes from Iowa. She was born and raised on a biodynamic dairy farm in Iowa and lived through the transition on that farm from biodynamic, which her family brought over from Germany, to what became colloquially known as conventional agriculture, industrial agriculture, using pesticides and artificial fertilizers and everything. She lived through that, although that experience nearly killed her. And we joined up about 22, 23 years ago and have been partners in this work ever since. So she's an essential part of what we're doing here.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, here with Michael Brownlee, author of Reclaiming the Future, How to Lead the Local Food Revolution in Your Community. You offer 7 steps of developing a local food system, or at least taking ourselves in that direction. And I think, Michael, too many people have tried to skip from step 1, having the vision, right into step 4, radicalization, without those essential first things that you mentioned, like making connections and making a realistic assessment of the current reality. Why do we need those hard steps first before we get radical?
Well, you know, as Gus Speth likes to say, and has inspired us to say to many other people, we will never do what is necessary unless we know the full extent of our predicament. And, you know, I think most of us, including yourself, as we've been trying to grasp what our situation on this planet really is, we're just only in the last few years starting to get a handle of the reality that this planet is sliding into what is now being called the Anthropocene epoch. It is a period of biosphere disaster. You know, this is the worst catastrophic event on this planet since an asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. And it's caused by primarily our use of fossil fuels on this planet, and the number one contributor to the advent of the Anthropocene is the global industrial food system. You know, so we haven't understood this. We haven't understood even that, you know, 100 years ago, our diet in this country, our food supply in this country, was 100% organic, 100% local. And in a very short period of time, mostly since World War II, the industrial food system, which has been created by what we call an unholy alliance of big ag, big food, big pharma, and big oil, all backed by big banking and big government. So this industrial food system has undermined and stolen from us our food supply. And in the process, it has undermined and essentially destroyed democracy in this country. And the only way that we can regain our democracy, our food security, our food sovereignty, and chart a path forward into the difficult time of the Anthropocene is to build highly localized regional food sheds that can be our very resilient lifeboats into this very dark time that we're heading into. So there I tried to summarize the whole book.
And did a great job. But the thing is, when you talk like that, I know from twice now, having sort of started from the ground up my own gardening and more of my own food production, which has been a very healing thing for me, I must say, it takes time. You got to build your soil up for a couple of years. You find out in the third year that there's a pest you'd never seen before. In the fourth year, the frost knocks you out. So there's this lag time. Now, if we had a rather sudden and steep decline in something like the 2010 heat wave that broke the Russian wheat production, if we had, you know, a big event, where are we going to find the knowledge that's been knocked out, the lost wisdom of how to grow things? People don't know where their food comes from or how to grow it. We could be in trouble.
Well, it's quite likely that something like that will happen along the way. You know, we're working to raise awareness now so that we don't have to be forced into localizing our food supply overnight, like what happened in Cuba. You know, many people have seen the film, The Power of Community, how Cuba survived peak oil. You know, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Cuba's supply of oil, which supported industrial agriculture there, was cut off. You know, and so they were plunged into a very difficult period of essentially starvation, and they had to shift off of fossil fuel-based food production to local organic production, and they did that in a matter of 18 months because they had to. They didn't have any choice. So it's in a way, it's a very inspiring story because people mobilized and they got the job done, even though during that 18 months, the average Cuban citizen lost about 20 pounds. And I don't think they were that overweight when that started. But what people forget is that Cuba was a dictatorship. So part of what made that transition possible was that Castro dismantled the large corporate farms and made that land available to small farmers across the country. Now, we don't have that kind of situation here, but we can see, if we look at the data, if we look at what's coming with global warming, we can chart out that we're facing a global food catastrophe. It's just that most people are not aware of it. Many scientists are, some that you've spoken to. But we can begin now to prepare for that by learning how to build our local food systems. And that includes, as you talked about, each of us learning how to grow as much of our own food as we can. And it turns out that that's not as hard as many of us have been made to believe. You know, we're working right now with a gentleman in Durango, Colorado, Tom Bartels, who has a website called Grow Food Well. He's been growing food in his backyard at 6,500 feet in Durango. He's producing on a 1,200 square foot plot in his backyard. He's been growing over 1,000 pounds of his own food every year, which is about a third of what he and his wife need. But he only spends 4 or 5 hours a week on that garden. So what he's doing is teaching people how to produce food very efficiently, food that's very, very nutritious, and to be able to grow it year-round. So we're bringing Tom into the Local Food Academy to begin training other people in the academy on how they can grow their own food as much as possible, but also how to train others in their communities to do the same thing.
I'm going to look up that website. Sounds good.
Tom is outstanding, and he is one of the things I greatly appreciate is he's very well informed about the issues that you talk about on your show. He knows what's coming, and that's exactly why he's doing what he's doing. He's teaching others how to build local food production.
Michael Brownlee, do you think there's room for new technology like aquaponics or solar power in this revolutionized local food supply?
Well, I think that we will see lots of new technologies come in, and we're all already seeing that. You know, when we first started learning about hydroponics and aquaponics and year-round greenhouses, we were very encouraged because we thought that those could be great strategies. But what we're seeing is that the industrial food system is co-opting those technologies. They see that there's great opportunity there. So they're taking advantage of that and building huge systems. And the downside of that, there are several, but one of the worst is that they're driving small farmers out of existence. Small farmers cannot compete with that kind of industrial scale of production. you know, an over-reliance on technology is kind of what's gotten us into this predicament of the Anthropocene in the first place. And I think we need to be really cautious in trying to solve our problems with more technology when it turns out that just building soil is the most effective thing that we can be doing for building local food systems. It's the most effective thing that we can be doing in terms of healing and restoring and regenerating our ecosystem. So these new industrial technologies that you're talking about, they don't contribute to any of that at all. They are not regenerative systems. They will ultimately contribute to the demise of our ecosystem.
Interesting. I'm going to ask you for an update on a couple of organizations we encountered in our last Radio EcoShock interview. And the first was, now I'm going to mispronounce this, is it Poudre Valley Community Farms?
Poudre Valley Community Farms up in Fort Collins, yes. So this is a very interesting development. You know, a young farming couple up there reached a point where they couldn't grow their farm anymore. Land access is a huge problem for young farmers, almost any farmers these days. Land is getting up to about $30,000 an acre up there. So what happened was their community of customers, they had a large CSA, but then there are a lot of people in Fort Collins who are interested in food localization. They formed a multi-stakeholder cooperative to buy farmland and lease it back to young local farmers and give them a long-term lease, which would make it possible for them to stay on that land for 20, 30 years. So this is the first time that we have seen that kind of a model happen anywhere in the country. And they're in the process. They've had a few setbacks, but they're in the process of purchasing their first significant acreage right now. But they've raised the money for it. They've gotten tremendous local support. Even the local government there has gotten behind it as well. That's a very, very encouraging project.
Okay, the Taproot Cooperative. Talk to us about that.
Taproot is, you know, to me, one of the most exciting things that's happening. This grew out of originally a group of small farmers out in eastern Kansas who were growing local, growing organic food, being surrounded by industrial food production out there. The population out in that part of the state had shrunk so much that they didn't have a market. So they wanted to see how they could get their produce and their meat to market in the Front Range of Colorado. So they've organized together. Several farmer organizations have formed cooperatives. So this is Taproot is now a network of five farmer-owned food hubs who've joined together as a cooperative to build an infrastructure backbone to move food from eastern Kansas and Nebraska and eastern Colorado into the very hungry Front Range market of Colorado, where most of Colorado's population lives. I say hungry, they're hungry for healthy local food, but are having a hard time finding access to it. So Taproot is, again, it's the first network of farmer-owned cooperative food hubs that we have seen in the country, and we think that this may turn out to be a replicable model.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You're tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith, and I'm with Michael Brownlee. We're talking about developing, I'd say, the next generation of local food shift leaders, and that's what Michael and his partner are all about with their new book and new courses that they're offering. I'm wondering, Michael, maybe there's some places in Asia where village farming is still producing local food, and that may be the main source of nourishment for people around there. Is there a way to learn from that, to link up with that? There must be a ton of things we could learn from people all over the world.
I think that that's true. I mean, there are many places in the world where smallholder farming is still the dominant paradigm. There are a few places where the industrial food system has not co-opted that and brought in the green revolution. I think it's incumbent on us to go out and learn how they're doing it, see what we can apply from what they have learned over, sometimes many centuries. And I think that we also need to go back and look at the history of indigenous populations and see how they lived. You know, I was recently reading a book by Charles Massey in Australia, The Call of the Reed Warbler, which is a fantastic book. And Massey was saying that Western civilization arrived in Australia in, I think it was 1789, something like that, when the Europeans arrived, much later than happened here in this country. So it's a little easier for them to look back and see what was happening before the arrival of the Europeans. And what he describes is the Aboriginal people were living in regions that were largely self-sufficient in terms of food. And they had their own language, but they were all connected on a spiritual level with each other. There were like 250 tribes like this. And as I read about what was happening there, these sound like localized bioregions to me, and they may provide a model for us to go back and study that give us kind of a direction for where we might need to be going in the future. I'd just say, especially in the context of some of the speakers and authors that you've had on your show, it's pretty likely now that over the next, century or so, we're going to see a dramatic change on this planet, including a dramatic reduction in human population. We will be reorganizing how we live on this planet, those who are left. I mean, we are living in the time of a dying civilization, and almost always civilizations end with some sort of agricultural disaster, and that's what we're facing now. So we need to be able to build now our lifeboats to get through this difficult time, and we just don't see any other alternative out there that has legs other than highly regionalized food sheds, local food systems that can support local populations.
It's going to come down to that. I agree. I don't know when. Who can become a local food leader? Do we need a college degree? Do we need business experience? Do we need great public speaking skills? What are the requirements?
Well, it turns out that almost none of us have those kinds of things. The primary requirement seems to be the individuals who are deeply called to this work. They know that that's why they're here on the planet. They're totally committed, they're totally passionate, and they're looking for others that they can work with. And we're finding them. I mean, there are not maybe millions of them now, but we're finding them all over the country and in other countries as well. We just talked to a Peace Corps, a young Peace Corps volunteer in Macedonia this week, who's going to be joining the academy because she sees that this is what her life is about. So that's who we're looking for. And those people might be already involved in local food work or not. They might be farmers. We have several farmers and ranchers in the local food academy right now. They might be local food entrepreneurs or people who are involved in local food policy. but they're beginning to understand at a very deep, and I would say spiritual level, that this really is a matter of great urgency and importance for the human species right now.
Well, let's get in some connection points here. Michael, can you give us a website, a Twitter handle, Facebook page? How do people connect and find out more?
Right now, the best way is to go to localfoodshift.com. That's localfoodshift.com. And that will connect you into our system and offer you a free download of our book, Reclaiming the Future, How to Lead the Local Food Revolution in Your Community. And then that will lead you to links with information about the Local Food Academy as well.
And as we wrap up, I want to admit that there is a spiritual side to all this. I mean, we don't want to convert people to a religion, but we believe in something so strongly, we want everyone to come along, don't you think?
The universe itself has a very strong direction. You know, Martin Luther King Jr., I believe in Selma or Montgomery back in the 60s, said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And there is an evolutionary direction of this universe that we can align with and that we can learn to embody. And we think of that as a spiritual discipline. And the most exciting thing to us about this local food revolution that's beginning to break out all over the place is that this is this bending towards justice of the universe at work. This is a process of healing and restoration and regeneration that is just beginning to take hold on our planet.
From Colorado, we've been talking with the Dean of Local Food Revolutionaries, Michael Brownlee. His latest book is Reclaiming the Future, How to Lead the Local Food Revolution in Your Community. And check out his many free online resources, and you can even look through the book online if you like and get some ideas from that. I'd also maybe buy the book and pass it on to others. It's a good way to do it. Michael, thank you so much for being out there in front.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be with you today.
Radio EcoShock.
Time to save the world's coral reefs is rapidly running out. That's the word from new science out of Australia. If the nurseries of the seas go extinct, everything changes. The paper is Spatial and Temporal Patterns of Mass Bleaching of Corals in the Anthropocene. It's just come out in the prestigious journal Science. Our guest is co-author Dr. Andrew H. Baird from the James Cook University in Queensland, Australia, right on the Great Barrier Reef. Andrew Baird is the Professorial Research Fellow and Chief Investigator at the Australian Research Council Center of Excellence in Coral Reef Studies. He's published over 140 peer-reviewed articles, many in top world science journals. Andrew, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much, Alex.
In June of 2016, we talked with the grandfather of coral science, Charles Varon, and Charlie had just returned from an aerial survey of the Great Barrier Reef. He was very glum. What has happened to the Great Reef over the past couple of years, Andrew?
There have been two large-scale bleaching events, one in 2016 and then again in 2017. The first event affected mostly the northern third of the Great Barrier Reef. The second event affected the sort of middle third. And as a result of those two bleaching events, you know, we estimate that we've lost about 50% of the coral colonies in the shallow waters. So it's a mortality event without precedent.
Now, when you say lost, does that mean they're just not coming back, those particular parts of the reef?
No, it means that the individual colonies have died. And so it will take new individuals to replace the ones that have died. It doesn't mean that the reefs themselves can't come back, but those colonies are gone.
Here in North America, I know that when forests burn, they usually rejuvenate unless there's another fire too soon within the next few years. Does that apply to coral colonies as well?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, as you said earlier, reefs have adapted in a regime of high disturbance, and historically those disturbances have been tropical storms. And so, you know, we have a lot of data on rates of recovery from tropical storms, and, you know, the typical time to get a reasonably good coral assemblage back is somewhere in the vicinity of 5 to 10 years. But the worry now is that the scale of this event is so big that there's very few corals left to breed, very few corals left to produce the new recruits, the coral babies that are required to power recovery.
Andrew, are we sure that coral bleaching is caused by global warming?
Look, coral bleaching at the level of an individual colony is a stress response, and any stress can cause a coral colony to bleach. So hot water, cold water, too much light, too little light, sediment pollution, all of these things can cause an individual colony to bleach. But there's no question that these large-scale bleaching events that we've been seeing since the 1980s, and not before that, are related to global warming.
So it's not a natural cycle that's been going on for centuries.
All of the records suggest that these large-scale bleaching events are a recent phenomenon. That includes evidence from people observing the reef, you know, which only really goes back to the 1930s, but also from coral cores, which go back a couple of hundred years. And so, you know, we can be very confident that the scale and frequency of these events is unprecedented in the recent history of corals.
So why did you do this new study, and how was it done?
The paper that's coming out in the next few days in Science is an analysis of the literature and the sea surface temperature records. We did it as to provide some context to the empirical work that we've been doing on the Great Barrier Reef. And so we just wanted to look in detail at the history of these bleaching events since the 1980s. And, you know, what we've shown is that the return times for these bleaching events are becoming much shorter. So, you know, back in the 1980s to about the year 2000, at any one location, you would expect to see about 25 years elapsing between bleaching events. And in the last 20 years, that return time has decreased to about 5 years.
Wow, that's a big change.
It is. It's a big change. And as you said earlier, you know, forests can recover from bushfires as long as the next bushfire doesn't come along too soon. So that's the big issue. Even if there was enough coral broodstock left to power recovery, the frequency of these events is becoming so regular that it can make recovery much more difficult.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Andrew Baird. He's with the Center of Excellence in Coral Reef Studies in Queensland, Australia. How do you estimate, Andrew, the current health of the Great Barrier Reef following those terrible bleachings in 2016 and again another punch in 2017?
Well, we did a number of aerial surveys to sort of document the scale of the bleaching, and then we followed them up by going out in boats and getting in the water and counting the corals. So the last time we did that as part of this large scale study was in 2016, and then again, you know, we've been out as individuals to various areas of the reef. So I was at Lizard Island back in December to look at some other research questions that I'm involved in. And, yeah, no, the reef was as bad as I have ever seen it in sort of 30 years of working on the reef. So people are out there continuing to monitor the status of the reef. We were also planning another large-scale experiment to look at recruitment. So as I was saying earlier, recovery from these events relies on new individuals coming into the population, and so we're testing for the levels of recruitment post-bleaching. So we're monitoring the reef in a number of different ways.
Where are some of the other places in the world where great reefs are found?
Most of the reefs obviously are found in a band around the equator, and so Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, Australia, the Great Barrier Reef. We've also got extensive reef systems on the west coast, and there's quite a lot of reef in the Caribbean as well.
Do scientists really know what the sea temperature threshold is where warm water coral reefs begin to vanish from the Earth?
No, that is a good question. And I don't think we could say that with any certainty. I mean, I think most people accept that if we can't keep atmospheric rises in temperature to less than 2 degrees centigrade, we're going to lose a lot of reefs. There are a number of times throughout the Earth's history that we've lost coral reefs. They sort of, in geological time, they blink on and blink off, and they weren't necessarily what we modern reefs, but reefs have disappeared for periods of 10 million years over the course of the human history, and well, not human history, sorry, over the course of the world's history. I mean, we do know that climate can cause extinction of reefs on a global scale, because it has happened before.
Of course, the Queensland tourism industry can't exactly wait 10 million years for all that money to come back in, so this is very serious for Australia as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think there could well be serious economic implications. Certainly, tourism is one. Reefs provide a lot of other goods and services for people. A large proportion of the world's population depend on reefs for food. Reefs also provide protection from storm waves. There are serious economic implications from losing our reefs.
The paper is Spatial and Temporal Patterns of Mass Bleaching of Corals in the Anthropocene. It's just come out in the prestigious journal Science. From Queensland, Australia, we've been talking with co-author and coral investigator Dr. Andrew Baird. Find more links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
Yep, thank you, Alex. Thanks very much for interesting our work.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
No matter how green local voters, multinational companies have repeatedly tried to use Portland, Oregon, as a base to export more fossil fuels and more greenhouse gases. Companies tried a coal export terminal, then a dangerous propane loading facility. In December 2016, Portland said no, with a new bylaw called the Fossil Fuel Terminal Zoning Amendments. That was shot down by another government body. But last week, appeals courts gave some climate-fighting power back to the people of Portland. It's a win and a test case for a lot of cities. Let's get the goods from Nicholas Caleb. He's the staff attorney at the Center for Sustainable Economy, one of a half dozen nonprofits, including environmentalists, lawyers, and doctors, who fought for this right. Nick, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
What was the Portland bylaw meant to do?
So the Portland Fossil Fuel Terminal Zoning Amendments, as they're formally called, were the result of about a three-year campaign that only makes sense in the context of understanding the Pacific Northwest's unique place in the fight against fossil fuel industry. So years back, Sightline Institute did a report that showed that there were 28, at that time, proposed fossil fuel export terminals being proposed in our area, and the combined volume of the carbon pass-through would be equivalent to about 5 times what was going to go through the Keystone XL pipeline. And one volume of Keystone XL pipeline, according to climate scientists, was climate game over. So we're basically facing an apocalyptic push of fossil fuels to our region, and people started stepping up and fighting those projects one by one. And to date, none of them have been certified. So in Portland, early on, we were sort of spared any direct terminal applications. We had some oil trains and coal that was going to pass through, but nothing direct. And then in 2014, we got a proposal from a Canadian oil giant, Pembina, that they wanted to bring in a propane export terminal that would have been the biggest facility in Portland history, the biggest investment in Portland history. And so we mobilized and were able to defeat that in a crazy campaign that I can tell you more about if you want to know. But that led to us passing a resolution in Portland saying we oppose all new fossil fuel infrastructure. And then a year after that, culminating in December of 2016, we passed an ordinance, these fossil fuel terminal zoning amendments, which prohibited large-scale fossil fuel infrastructure for storage and transport, effectively a fossil fuel infrastructure ban.
And who shot that down?
So after we passed it at the local level, industry in the form of the Portland Business Alliance, which is our local chamber of commerce, the Western States Petroleum Association, a large oil industry lobbying firm in the Pacific Northwest, and the Columbia River Buildings Trades, the local buildings trades, sued us in land use court. And so in Oregon, we have unique land use laws, but they took us there. Sued us, said that our ordinance violated the Dormant Commerce Clause of the Constitution and several land use procedure policies, and the Land Use Board of Appeals, in a very strange posture where two of the three hearings officers recused themselves. One hearings officer declared that, yes, this in fact did violate the Dormant Commerce Clause of the Constitution and several land use policies. And so it was a big letdown at first because, you know, we got heard by a sort of like an administrative court and we lost. And so our allies across the country were a bit, you know, sullen about this. And we were like, no, wait, you know, as soon as we get a proper court that's competent to hear constitutional questions, it's going to go the other way. And that's exactly what happened in our appeal.
I'm wondering, where does it go from here? Is it going to be appealed again back against you?
It could be. It's unclear right now. There's an appeal period where our opponents can decide whether they want to appeal it any further. The Oregon Court of Appeals gave us a decisive victory on the constitutional question. They left no question that we were good on constitutional grounds. There are a couple of land use technical procedures that we'll have to cure in order to reinstate our ban, but that should be easy to do on supplemental process. So we're assuming that the city will wait to hear back of whether this gets appealed to the Oregon Supreme Court or not before they make a policy choice in pursuing reinstatement of the ordinance. But that should happen, you know, very, very quickly. So we'll know probably within a month what's going to happen.
Well, since the U.S. national government seems to be abdicating its responsibility to protect citizens from things like climate-induced drought and forest fires, which of course can strike on the coast, and extreme storms again on the coast, how important do you see this case and the role of city governments across the United States?
It's extremely important, and it was even important under the Obama administration, where even though we were making progress, it was too slow. As I mentioned in the sort of introduction, we were facing this apocalyptic flood of fossil fuels, and the federal government wasn't stepping in to stop that. And so we had to innovate as local governments to say, okay, what are we going to do about this? How can we possibly say no? And so it took us a lot of like thought and investment of time to come up with these health and safety rules that protect us from the dangers of the fossil fuel industry, both in terms of spills, leaks, explosions, especially enhanced risk in the case of earthquakes in the Pacific Northwest, and then also the climate piece. And so now it's, like you suggest, it's even more necessary for us to take pretty strong steps in local government because the Trump administration is dismantling our environmental and climate rules so quickly. So yeah, what we did in Portland, we think now that a competent court, even though the precedent only extends to Oregon state court or Oregon state law, is at least a sign of how courts are going to interpret this type of local rule. So we think it's going to be a clear signal to our partners and other major port cities, but also cities that are fighting fossil fuel infrastructure all along its life cycle, that they can actually step up and pass local laws to restrict these types of developments and protect their residents.
Well, I have to point out on behalf of our Vancouver listeners at CFRO that the coal port denied in the Pacific Northwest did move to Vancouver, Canada. The Vancouver local government objected, but higher levels of government actually controlled the port there, and they built a new coal port export facility where American coal is being railroaded up and shipped off to Asia and with all the greenhouse gases. So I'm wondering, we're going to have to get some sort of way to prevent it from leaking out to other places when we stop it in one spot.
Yeah, there's absolutely no way to do climate work on an individual level. This type of work has to spread because, and then we hear it all the time, even from the companies themselves, they'll be like, well, it's going to get built somewhere, so do you want the benefits of it or not? And this is a very, like, immoral notion, in my opinion. But the only way that we can fight this is through solidarity across borders. I know we're in a strange position in the United States because at the federal level, we're weaker than we've ever been. And on the local level, we retain these health and safety powers that are, and the Supreme Court says, that are very strong. And so we suddenly can maybe experiment here. And then, like you suggest, there are interesting sort of contradictions in Canada that might make it harder for folks up there to fight these things. And so we've got to continue to find strategies so that we can shut down those leakage points.
And you mentioned it was quite a battle to get these citizens to be able to overcome. I mean, look, here's a big company coming and saying, we're going to spend billions, we're going to make all kinds of jobs, this is going to be great. To overcome that kind of argument and say, no, we don't want to wreck the world we have to live in the future, how did you do it? What were some of the things that other municipalities could do?
So in Portland, the city government has a good reputation for being a climate leader. Some of that is deserved and some of it's not. I mean, we were the first city to come up with a climate action plan in the 90s and so on and so forth. And we're respected for urban planning laws. But we didn't feel that the climate movement was adequately represented when it came to things like fossil fuels passing through. We just didn't think that they cared at all. And in fact, when Pembina came to town, our former mayor, Charlie Hales, was a big supporter of the project, saying that gas was a green fuel and that we were going to move in that direction. So we had to overcome an adversely oriented planning bureau and a mayor that basically said there's no way where he's possibly going to change his mind after he made public statements. And so we had to rally from the grassroots up. We found a lot of our environmental advocates were easy to bring in. But then we reached out to neighborhoods. We found scientists that understood seismic issues. We found people that would research gas and understood what was going on. We looked upstream to figure out what kind of human rights violations were going on in Canada at the source of this extraction. We brought in indigenous groups that testified and said that they were against the process. So we had to organize in a very short amount of time to bring people in. And because in the Pacific Northwest, some of that organizing had already taken place, that gave us a leg up. But we really just had to be scrappy and find our neighbors and other residents and get them to speak out in unison. And that's what was really effective. At the local level, city councils don't get the same volume of communication that state and federal governments do in the United States. So we were able to turn out something like 3,000 phone calls in a few weeks' time. And for even a city, like a medium-sized city like Portland, that's a huge amount of volume of communication on a specific issue. And so in about a 2 to 3 week period, we saw a total reversal of attitude on this because of that volume of people coming in. So in the United States, that's basically like the only form of real democracy that we have left is at the municipal government. And that wave of activism was able to move our city council, and they've been on a straight and narrow path ever since.
As we wrap up, Nick, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Yeah, I would say, and hopefully we can link it in your information, we at the Center for Sustainable Economy are very interested in helping other local governments who are working to stop fossil fuel infrastructure from being built or coming through in their communities. And we have this ban that we've been working on, but we also have a series of other tools that we have been building over the years. And so if folks are interested in this or have, you know, a grassroots base in their community or are looking to figure out how to build a grassroots base in their community, we would love to help. So feel free to reach out to me. And my email is nick@sustainable-economy.org. Feel free to send me an email. I'll be happy to talk with you.
Nick Caleb is from the Portland office of the Center for Sustainable Economy. Again, it's at sustainable-economy.org. And you can get a list of the other fossil fuel-free advocates behind this, like the Audubon Society of Portland, the Columbia River Keepers, 350 PDX, Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and the Craig Law Center. I'll put all that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for talking with us, Nick, and way to go, Portland.
Thanks very much.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. Wow, that's all we can squeeze in for this week. Next time, we'll ask experts why so many of you are so freezing cold, and maybe a few other things. Get to my website at ecoshock.org. Love to all. Alex.